Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
Opponents of the government locking up immigrants in poorly equipped detention centers bring their pleas to the Florida Capitol.
We're still here, we still have the same issues, and they're still not being addressed.
Even without a restrictive new law, it seems the job of registering returning citizens to vote is no easy task.
Shameful that we put up these additional barriers to grant them a right that they have as citizens.
We'll also learn how tough it's become for those who aren't lawmakers or appointed officials to bring a Florida constitutional amendment before the voters, and we'll discover a state-run savings program for people with disabilities has been significantly improved. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Florida's historic Capitol lawn was the backdrop for a protest this week calling for the closure of migrant detention centers. We get that story from Ryan Daly.
Organized by progressive group MoveOn.org, Close the Camps protests were held across the country this week. MoveOn planned the protests at legislators' local offices ahead of the holiday weekend, hoping the timing would mean members of Congress may be home for the 4th of July. Longtime lobbyist Barbara Devane was among the crowd, some of whom paid a visit to U.S. Senator Marco Rubio's office.
He, of all people that represent Florida, should understand why mothers and fathers would risk their lives to get their kids out of what they consider harm to their kids for a better life. And that's what America's all about.
Rubio's parents immigrated from Cuba in the late 1950s. The senator has weighed in on the issue via his YouTube channel in a video titled, "It's Time to Act on the Humanitarian Crisis at the Southern Border."
The crisis on the border can no longer be denied. It's a humanitarian crisis. Hundreds and thousands of people and children and families showing up at the border. They need to be housed and taken care of. We need the money to do that, but we also have to do more to stop this, to discourage people from taking this dangerous journey to the United States.
Rubio went on to say he's happy he and his colleagues in Congress have, quote, finally stepped up and provided funds the current administration has asked for, referring to a $4.6 billion humanitarian aid bill. Some other protesters at the Tallahassee event said they're tired of inaction from the Trump administration. Jeremy Block was one of those braving the afternoon heat to get a message out as drivers whizzed by on Appalachie Parkway.
This T-shirt I'm wearing about don't separate the families is a T-shirt I got at last year's rally right at this spot, and nothing has changed in the last 12 months. We're still here, we still have the same issues, and they're still not being addressed.
A number of Democratic presidential hopefuls visited the Homestead Detention Facility during debate week in South Florida. U.S. Senator Kamala Harris, who has enjoyed a bump in poll numbers since the debates, said one of her first priorities should she get elected would be to close private, for-profit detention centers.
So we are seeing a breakdown not only of our moral values, we're seeing a breakdown of our democracy.
Rubio took to Fox News in the days after the Democrats' week in South Florida to lob some criticisms.
They agree there's a crisis, but for them, the crisis is not that thousands and thousands of people are coming here with their children illegally. The crisis is that we're not allowing them to just walk in, sign a paper, and stay. That's the crisis for them.
But even with potential 2020 challengers to the Donald Trump presidency talking tough, protester Shari Gawanter is frustrated that nothing has moved on a policy level.
I think there's a lot of talk, and what we need is some action. I lost all of my family except for my mother and my grandparents and an aunt and uncle on my mother's side to the Holocaust. And what I'm seeing now feels just like that. So we can't stand by and do nothing. We have to do something.
About 60 people turned out to protest Tuesday at the Capitol. I'm Ryan Daly.
Thousands of felons throughout the state have the right to vote thanks to Amendment 4 and Governor Ron DeSantis signing the implementing bill into law. But to do so, they're going to have to register first. Capitol reporter Blaise Gainey joined former Leon County Commissioner Bob Ratcliffe as he went door to door doing just that.
We did Frenchtown and Griffin Heights and then Bond and then now Providence.
That's Bob Ratcliffe. He's talking about the places he's been going throughout Tallahassee in hopes of registering felons to vote.
In November, after the election, it was clear to me that we would not be able to get a significant number of returning citizens registered to vote without a concerted effort.
To help with the effort, Ratcliffe has been spending his weekends going door-to-door registering people to vote.
It's Bob Ratcliffe. Bob Ratcliffe.
On this day, he was in Tallahassee's Providence community.
Well, people move around a lot, so in neighborhoods like this. So it's you really have to go to every door. And then plus there aren't, when nobody's registered at an address, we go through it anyway. And if somebody is there, they may not be registered at all, or maybe they just moved. So it's very labor intensive, but it really has to be done. And
getting to their door is the first step, but getting people to register isn't guaranteed.
Well, you now have the right to vote.
If I don't have my rights back, what's the point of voting?
No, that's a good way to get your rights back.
If I don't have the right to own the gun, then what's the point of voting?
This man who didn't give his name was visibly annoyed. Amendment 4 only restores voting rights, not the right to bear arms, hold public office, or serve on a jury. Governor Ron DeSantis says he is considering whether to restore all civil rights to nonviolent felons. Ratcliffe has experience going door-to-door from his days of campaigning, and he says people not wanting to vote is a pattern he's noticed, especially with felons.
Well, you know, ex-felons are just the most marginalized people in our society. And they've been through a lot. They've really paid their dues. And it's shameful that we put up these additional barriers to allow them to grant them a right that they have as citizens to vote.
But not every felon feels that way.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're voting.
So did you know about Amendment 4, which allow felons to vote?
I heard about it. I didn't know it was passed.
Okay. That's something Ratcliffe has found a lot of during the past 4 months. But once he informs them and they want to register, next he checks to see if they qualify.
Nobody I've talked to so far was convicted of a murder or a felony sexual offense. So we ask them, have you completed your sentence? If the answer is yes, then we sign them up.
Completing the supervision portion of a sentence is one thing. The financial obligations is another.
Nobody knows better about having completed all the sentence than the ex-felon. The state certainly doesn't. There's no central database that's worth a damn.
Currently, all 67 districts have their own database, meaning if a person convicted a felony outside of the district they are registering in, it could take some work to find out if they owe fees and fines. Supervisors of election and county clerks want the legislature to provide funding for a central database, but as of now have not received it. For felons who do know how much they owe in court fines and fees, there are groups that are attempting to help pay them. The Florida Rights Restoration Coalition is the same group who got Amendment 4 on the ballot. Now it started a campaign called We Got the Vote. The goal is to raise $3 million that will go toward paying off fines and fees for felons looking to vote. I'm Blaise Gainey.
The State Elections Canvassing Commission this week formally certified the results of special elections that put Port St. Joe Republican Jason Schoaf, Dade City Republican Randy Maggard, and Coral Springs Democrat Dan Daly in the Florida House. The June 18th special elections were called after former House members Halsey Bashirs, Republican of Monticello, Danny Burgess, Republican of Zephyr Hills, and Jared Moskowitz, Democrat of Coral Springs, were appointed to lead up state agencies. Still to come on Capitol Report, Florida ramps up its laws against hazing.
We and 15 other families in the country belong to a club that we don't want any more members to. all their sons have died in hazing.
A new law creates new rules for amending the state constitution. While some say it's a dangerous blow to the democratic process, others argue it ensures the integrity of one of the most important state documents.
That was an attempt to preserve our constitution, to be treated like a constitution.
After what many found to be surprising success, Miami-Dade's needle exchange pilot project goes statewide.
We're actually reducing the overdoses. We are saving the state and saving the county money.
And Florida makes several positive changes to its special savings program for people with disabilities.
What's unique is they can save it or they can spend it right away. And so, you know, how people want to use their account is really up to them.
More people could face felony charges for hazing that results in severe injury or death. The state's previous rules frustrated prosecutors for years. But as Lynn Hatter reports, the death of a Florida State University student prompted the change.
Before there was Andrew Coffey or Robert Champion, there was Chad Meredith. The University of Miami student died in 2002 after trying to drunkenly swim across the school's Lake Osceola with his soon-to-be fraternity brothers. It was deemed a hazing-related death, and in the wake of it, the state made hazing that results in serious injury or death a third-degree felony. But several high-profile cases afterward saw few convictions. In 2011, Florida A&M University drum major Robert Champion was beaten aboard a bus parked in an Orlando hotel. He later died. 13 people were charged, but most of those charges were reduced to misdemeanors. Speaking to WFSU in 2013, attorney Chuck Hobbs noted the challenges in securing felony hazing convictions and said reduced charges send the wrong message.
Until prosecutor offices start putting people in prison 5-10 years or longer on some of these charges, that it's not going to resonate the same way. Because at the end of the day, a lot of these students are simply hard-headed, and they don't believe that anything is going to happen to them beyond, worst-case scenario, a slap on the wrist.
Hobbs has represented a number of students charged with hazing over the years, including one of the two students convicted of a felony. In the Champion case, students were quick to call 911 when they realized he was struggling. But that's not what happened 5 years later, when Florida State University fraternity pledge Andrew Coffey died surrounded by people.
So there was we had a party last night, and my friend passed out on the couch on his side. Mm-hmm. And His lips are purple, his body's extremely stiff, and I can't wake him up, and I honestly don't feel a pulse.
That 911 call came around 9 in the morning after. A grand jury blasted the fraternity and partygoers, who it said were more concerned about getting into trouble than saving Coffey's life. He drank a bottle of liquor and passed out. No one realized he was in trouble until the next morning when he did not wake up. 9 students were charged initially with felonies. Those were later reduced to misdemeanors.
We and 15 other families in the country belong to a club that we don't want any more members to. All their sons have died in hazing to a pledge, a fraternity. And we'd never want to see this happen again.
Tom and Sandy Coffey, Andrew's parents, delivered testimony to Florida lawmakers earlier this year, urging them to update the state's hazing law. Under new rules, anyone who solicits a person to commit hazing or is actively involved in it can be charged with a third-degree felony. The hope is that students won't get off as easy.
So we think this amendment to the statute of hazing statute will enhance it and put people on notice that they can't just do what they do without any kind of consequences.
The new law also provides immunity to the first person who calls 911.
Andrew Coffey would probably be alive today if somebody had called 911 at 3:00 in the morning.
Attorney David Bianchi represents Coffey's parents, and he wrote the language. The measure also expands who cannot be hazed to include both fraternity pledges and existing members. That additional language came after a member of a different FSU fraternity sustained a brain injury after he was punched in the face during a, quote, scumbag of the week ritual. I'm Lynn Hatter.
Floridians are working to gather signatures to get as many as 20 proposed constitutional amendments on the 2020 ballot. But as Regan McCarthy reports, a new law creates new barriers for moving so-called citizens' initiatives forward.
One thing is clear. The best interests of the public were not served.
Patty Brigham is the president of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Following the close of the legislative session, she held a news conference and accused lawmakers of, quote, clear disregard for the democratic process.
We witnessed on the last night of session a tax bill amended to add unrelated language imposing, again, unjustifiable barriers to citizens engaging in the political process. This dishonest politicking is counter to the principles of our democracy and unbecoming of any legislative body.
Scott McCoy, senior policy counsel with the Southern Poverty Law Center, joined Brigham. He says lawmakers are frustrated by the proposed changes citizens pushed last year, like Amendment 4, which sought to automatically restore a felon's right to vote.
One of the ways that they're trying to prevent any more Amendment 4s or other good ballot initiatives like medical marijuana, like environmental measures, like a minimum wage, is to now restrict the means by which citizens can put measures on the ballot through signature gathering barriers, and also by putting a thumb on the scale in the voting booth by requiring ridiculous disclosures in order to try and deter voters from voting for good measures in the ballot box.
Tampa Republican Representative James Grant was behind the last-minute move to amend a bill focused on rules for local sales tax referendums to include language from another bill that creates new rules for how everyday people can amend the state constitution.
Many of you remember I had House Bill 7111 that was an attempt to preserve our constitution to be treated like a constitution. This amendment is a follow-up, I believe, improved work product on that. Here's what that bill does. It requires each paid petition circulator not to be paid based on the number of petitions gathered, which is something we've talked about. They are eligible to be paid, obviously. They just cannot be paid based on the number of petitions.
The new rules also require people gathering signatures to get a proposal on the ballot to first register with the Secretary of State. And the bill puts new language on the ballot regarding the expected financial impact of the proposed amendments. Grant isn't the only one to raise concerns about the number of changes made to the Florida Constitution. Lawmakers can also propose amendments, and changes can be suggested by the Constitution Revision Commission, a body that meets once every 20 years. The commission met in 2017 and proposed a number of amendments to the ballot in 2018 that stirred up controversy because they bundled issues many felt weren't connected. Orange Park Republican Senator Rob Bradley filed a bill to limit the commission to a single subject, and St. Petersburg Republican Senator Jeff Brandis filed a bill to abolish the Constitution Revision Commission completely.
As I've said before, this is kind of like the Pandora's box of policy. We don't really know what's going to come out of these commissions. It only meets once every 20 years. It still maintains the two provisions that we allow for a constitution to be adjusted, either by the legislature by three-fifths or by a petition of the people. So I think that's, you know, essentially 19 out of 20 years the way that it works, and then the 20th year there's this process by which 37 unelected people get to propose amendments to the Constitution, and we frankly just don't know how it's going to shape out.
The bills by Bradley and Brandis died during session, but Grant's language passed. The rules banning petition circulators from being paid per signature went into effect when Governor Ron DeSantis signed the bill into law in June. The rest of the rules go into effect this weekend. I'm Regan McCarthy.
After years of just saying no, lawmakers from across Florida's mostly conservative legislature okayed a bill this year that would legalize needle exchanges. Those exchanges let injection drug users trade in their dirty needles for clean ones, thereby preventing the spread of HIV and hepatitis C. Governor Ron DeSantis signed the bill into law last week, and as Sammy Mack from WLRN tells us, the new statewide program is being based on a pilot program in Miami.
Decades of research show that needle exchanges are an effective way to reduce HIV and hepatitis C infection among injection drug users. And it works like this. Bring in one dirty needle and swap it for one clean needle. That means no need to share dirty needles. Each time somebody comes in to make an exchange, they get offered HIV and hep C testing. There's referrals to rehab, some primary care. But it's taken years for Florida lawmakers to come around to it. Republican State Senator Rob Bradley first voted against needle exchanges 6 years ago. He looked incredulous at a committee hearing about it.
You're trying to make sure the person has a clean needle, which is outweighing the idea of the person breaking the law.
This is the main objection from conservative lawmakers. They fear these programs support illegal drug abuse. But public health workers say needle exchanges minimize harm to people who are vulnerable and often hard to treat. HIV rates in South Florida are consistently among the highest in the country. And that's why Florida Democratic State Senator Oscar Brannon kept sponsoring needle exchange bills year after year.
We're ground zero, the South is, for some of the opioid addictions, for the AIDS epidemic, because we haven't been doing those things that help stop that.
In 2016, Miami-Dade County got permission to try the exchange for 5 years. The data collected from this pilot exchange has been a key to winning over skeptics.
And that's because the numbers don't lie.
In just 3 years, the program has pulled more than 250,000 used needles out of circulation. And there's a bonus. The exchange has a partnership to hand out the drug that reverses overdoses, Narcan. That Narcan has prevented more than 1,000 overdoses. Also, users get special plastic boxes to hold their needles.
We are actually stopping the spread of HIV. We're actually reducing the overdoses. We are saving the state and saving the county money.
Brannon says there were compromises to get the bill through. Mainly, counties have to opt in. And they have to find a way to pay for it without using state or local money. In Miami, the pilot exchange gets support from the University of Miami and private donors like the drug maker Gilead. Getting support from law enforcement also helped sway lawmakers, though that didn't happen immediately, says Eldis Diaz. He's the executive officer to the Miami Chief of Police.
It would seem that law enforcement would be a natural antagonist to an organization like the Needle Exchange.
The head of Miami's police union vehemently opposed the exchange when it opened. He suggested the exchange encourage drug use, and he blamed the exchange for an officer getting stuck with a dirty needle. But at a recent forum in Miami, Diaz said the department now sees the needle exchange as a positive force.
I don't know if anybody here has ever reached into someone's pocket and felt a loose needle, but that is terrifying. Now for our officers, when they're doing a pat down, every time you feel that sharps container, which is really protecting you from a loose needle, 100% of the time that you're feeling it, that's an extraordinary source of comfort for us.
Those are the kinds of results that led a lot of Republicans who started out against the exchanges, like Rob Bradley, to come around.
I just want to say when I started my career in the Senate, I voted against the pilot project, and I was wrong.
To be clear, it's really unusual to hear an elected official in Tallahassee say they've been wrong.
And the results speak for themselves. It's very good public policy.
Bradley and the rest of the Florida Senate voted unanimously in favor this year. The Florida House voted overwhelmingly for it, too, 111-3. Dr. Hansel Tooks runs Miami's exchange, and he's been pushing for this legislation since he was a medical student. He was in the Capitol when it finally passed.
And I just had this overwhelming feeling like, oh my God, we just did the impossible, and we're going to save so many people in this state.
Now that needle exchanges are legal statewide, it's up to each county to decide whether or not to opt in. For Health News Florida, I'm Sammy Mack in Miami.
You're listening to Capitol Report from WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, there are lots of ways to save money, and many are custom tailor-made for specific folks, including Floridians with disabilities.
Able United is a state-run program. It's a tax-advantaged savings account for individuals with disabilities and their families to be able to save, put money aside. It can have tax-free growth and not impact the eligibility for government benefits like Supplemental Security Income or Medicaid.
Keep that last part about not impacting other government benefits in mind for a few moments, because we'll come back to that. And the speaker, by the way, is John Finch. He's Able United's director and has been with the program since it began 3 years ago. He notes it's part of another organization that has a lot of expertise in managing savings accounts.
The benefit of this program is it's run by the Florida Prepaid College Board, a program that has 30-year history here in the state of Florida in helping over a million families save for higher education and college expenses through the prepaid or the college savings program.
Finch says participation in the Able United Savings Program has been growing, a bit slowly for sure, but growing nonetheless.
So we have about 3,300 accounts with a total amount invested from all those accounts close to $15 million. So it's a good program that gives you an average account balance of $5,000. So we are seeing people save it. And what's unique is they can save it or they can spend it right away. And so, you know, how people want to use their account, it's really up to them.
Still, Finch admits there has been one big downside to the plan.
But one drawback was that the state, if the beneficiary passed away and all outstanding qualified disability expenses have been paid, that the state could file a claim to get back some of the funds in your ABLE account to help cover the costs that they received for Medicaid services.
Meaning the survivors of the account holder could wind up with a bill from the state after the funeral. All that changed, says Finch, as a result of this year's legislative session.
HB 6047 was passed this year. Governor signed it, and basically it kind of clarified that provision, which now instead of the state being able to file a claim, they will no longer be able to file a claim for Medicaid recovery. Instead, that the funds, if there was anything left over, would go to the beneficiary's estate.
And Finch says that isn't the only improvement in the program.
There's some exciting new features that happen along with this transition. We have an FDIC insurance savings option now, so some people can use this as a savings account instead of just an investment vehicle. We have live chat on our website now, so some people, they don't want to call on the phone anymore. They'd rather just chat away through text on our website, so that capability's there. And hopefully we'll be rolling out a prepaid card later this year that'll allow people greater flexibility and access to their funds.
As far as an upper limit for how much can be saved, Finch says that limit really doesn't exist for all practical purposes.
If you're on SSI, it's a $100,000 limit. Anything above that will count to that. But I tell people, hey, if you're into $100,000, tell me your secret for saving. After that, if you're not really worried about the SSI, these accounts can get up to $418,000 before you can no longer contribute to them.
With all the changes now in place, Finch says he expects a lot more people will take advantage of the program.
We estimate that close to a million people here in the state of Florida are eligible for an Able United account. And so having that onset of disability prior to age 26 and being a Florida resident, you know, as long as the disability is severe or you're receiving government benefits because of your disability, you could open one of these accounts and it's done online.
Anyone who wants to learn if an Able United account is a good idea for them or someone they know can find out in a few clicks.
The best place to go is our website, www.ableunited.com. There you can go and find a wealth of information, find out if you're eligible to open the account, and open an account and manage it.
Our regular Capital Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Blaise Ganey, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Sean Mulcahy. Technical assistance for Capital Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Be sure to join us again next week at this time for more reports from the State Capitol.
Capital Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee. For more information about Capital Report and to hear previous episodes, visit WFSU.org. Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following: the Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org.